You're listening to the second and final part of Unexplained, Season 7, Episode 22, Jumping into Legend. Before Northwest Orient Airlines, Flight 305, had even made it safely to the ground, the FBI launched what would become one of its longest, most rigorous, and most frustrating investigations of all time. When the plane landed in Reno and agents began sweeping the scene of so-called Dan Cooper's crime, they were initially optimistic. Despite the effort to cover his tracks, the man had left behind plenty of evidence to get started with, including a clip-on tie, an ashtray full of cigarette butts, and more than 60 sets of fingerprints, not to mention all the eyewitnesses. And although they didn't know exactly where the so-called Cooper had parachuted out of the plane, they could make an educated guess. Assuming he jumped shortly after sending Tina into the cockpit, they estimated that he would have landed somewhere in the Cascade Mountains in either southern Washington or northern Oregon. That said, it was impossible to know the jet's airspeed at the moment the man jumped, what direction the wind was blowing, or how long he'd spent in freefall before activating his parachute. As soon as the sun rose on that Thanksgiving day in 1971, police and federal agents began scouring the forests in the area on foot and by helicopter. The search went on for days, slowed down by dense fog, and ultimately turned up nothing at all. The so-called Cooper, his parachute, and his bag of money had all vanished without a trace. About 3,000 miles east of Reno in Washington, D.C., the Bureau began creating a profile of the hijacker. The science of criminal profiling was still in its nascent stages in 1971. The FBI's Behavioral Science Unit wouldn't be formally established until the following year, but it was ideal for a situation like this. Profiling means extrapolating an unknown criminal's personality traits by analyzing the crimes they've committed. The more information an investigator has about their methods and behavior, the more useful a profile is likely to be. And thanks to the number of people Cooper interacted with during his heist, the feds had plenty to go on. They interviewed the whole flight crew and multiple passengers. Unsurprisingly, it was Tina Mucklow and Florence Schaffner, the two flight attendants who'd spent the most time with the hijacker, who had the best insights. From those interviews, they established the following. The man was probably local to the Washington area, because he'd recognized the city of Tacoma from the air. He possibly had a background in the Air Force because he'd said something about the drive time between the airport and a local Air Force base, and he was likely in dire financial straits. Why else commit such an audacious, high-risk crime for money, they thought. Based on his mannerisms, vocabulary, and behavior, they also figured he was probably of above-average intelligence, and all of the eyewitnesses gave similar physical descriptions. The apparent Cooper was a man in his mid-40s, around 5'10", with a high hairline of black hair and an olive complexion. Armed with this detailed profile, investigators began questioning potential suspects. The authorities referred to the hijacker as Dan Cooper because that was the name he'd given when he purchased his plane ticket. Soon after the event, Portland police found a local man with the name D.B. Cooper, who had a minor criminal record. This man was eliminated as a suspect almost immediately, but in a roundabout way, his police interview became an important part of the saga. A local reporter, rushing to meet his deadline for the evening paper, accidentally reported the suspect's name as the one used by the hijacker. And so it was from that point on that our enigmatic, sunglass-wearing hijacker came to be known as the mythic D.B. Cooper. As the days passed, and the story gathered more and more coverage, the D.B. Cooper mythology only grew. Normally, hijackers were not considered heroes, but there was something different about this one. People were fascinated by him. This seemingly ordinary man in a pressed suit, who hijacked a plane without resorting to any physical violence, successfully extorted $200,000 from the feds, and then vanished, like James Bond, into the night with his fortune. However, investigators were not optimistic about his fate. In fact, it was acknowledged from the very start that they might well be looking for a dead man. Logically, it was unlikely that Cooper could have survived his jump. For a start, it's likely that he had no skydiving experience. Aside from requesting that they weren't military grade, he gave no other instructions as to what kind of parachutes he wanted exactly. The set he received were rudimentary, with no ability to maneuver them, meaning he had no control over where he ended up. He'd also jumped into a densely wooded area in complete darkness, in 200 mile per hour wind, on a foggy night, when visibility couldn't have been worse. And he'd done it all, wildly underdressed, in only a suit, a thin trench coat, and a pair of loafers. The man also hadn't given the crew any specific flight path to follow, beyond telling them to aim for Mexico City and fly low. If he'd had a detailed plan in mind for his landing, or an accomplice waiting for him on the ground, it's likely he would have been far more specific. In fact, many FBI agents believed that the man probably never even got his parachute open, because the cold would have been paralyzing. Meanwhile, the search continued, expanding into the Columbia River between Washington and Oregon, but no body was found, and eventually they stopped looking for one. In the first 5 years after the hijacking, the FBI considered more than 800 suspects in its effort to identify D.B. Cooper. Many of them were ruled out quickly for a variety of reasons. Some had reliable alibis, others didn't match the physical description provided by eyewitnesses, and some were eliminated through the use of early DNA analysis extrapolated from Cooper's clip-on tie. One of the most compelling suspects, however, emerged only 5 months after the hijacking, in the spring of 1972. On April 7th, 1972, in Denver, Colorado, a man going by the name James Johnson, with a slim face and high hairline similar to the so-called D.B. Cooper, boarded a United Airlines flight to Los Angeles. 20 minutes after the plane took off, a flight attendant noticed that the man was holding what appeared to be a hand grenade. When confronted, Johnson pulled out a pistol and gave a note to the flight attendant, demanding $500,000 in cash and 4 parachutes, in return for which he would let the plane's 84 other passengers go. The plane was diverted to San Francisco, where Johnson received his ransom and duly released the passengers. Just like the Cooper hijacking, Johnson insisted the flight crew stay on board and take him back into the air. It was a near identical crime, except that Johnson had more than doubled Cooper's payday. And once the plane took off again, another key difference emerged. Johnson gave the pilots a very specific flight path to follow, telling them to climb to an altitude of 16,000 feet and then follow a path which would take them over a specific region of Utah. He then sent all flight crew into the cockpit, took his ransom, and parachuted out of the back of the plane using a set of aft stairs that opened up from under the aircraft. Unlike Cooper, Johnson had clearly planned his getaway. Ironically, this actually made the authorities' job a lot easier. On top of the fingerprints and handwriting sample he'd left behind, they knew he likely had ties to the area. 2 days after the hijacking, Johnson was arrested at his home in the city of Provo in Utah, mere miles from where he'd landed. Only the man wasn't called James Johnson, but Richard Floyd McCoy, a 30-year-old Vietnam veteran originally from North Carolina. When police busted his home, they found the $500,000 of ransom money still in his possession. It was an open and shut case, and McCoy was soon found guilty and sentenced to 45 years behind bars. But some people, including members of law enforcement, were convinced that McCoy was not a mere copycat criminal. They believed that he was D.B. Cooper. The theory went like this. After carrying out the original hijacking, McCoy had become cocky. His notoriety had gone to his head, and greed took over. He started wishing he'd asked for a bigger ransom. After all, they'd handed over the $200,000 with no hesitation. And so, buoyed by his success the first time around, he went back for another piece of the pie. Despite the neatness of McCoy as a fit for D.B. Cooper, the more the FBI looked into the possibility, the less credible it became. For one thing, despite the high hairline, McCoy didn't match the physical description of Cooper in any other way. For another, he had a solid alibi for the night of the Cooper hijacking. He'd been in Las Vegas on that day and at home with his family enjoying Thanksgiving dinner the day after. After serving 2 years of his sentence, in 1974, Richard McCoy escaped from prison alongside several fellow inmates and went on the run. 3 months later, he was tracked down and subsequently killed in a shootout with law enforcement. When Nicholas O'Hara, the FBI agent who fired the fatal shot, spoke to the media soon after, he insisted that contrary to what most of his colleagues believed, when he shot Richard McCoy, he also shot D.B. Cooper. McCoy remains a popular suspect among aficionados of the Cooper case, but he's far from the only one. In the autumn of 1971, residents of a leafy New Jersey suburb began to notice something strange in their neighborhood. Walking past a large Victorian mansion on a road called Hillside Avenue, they saw that all of the lights had been left on, and they stayed that way for weeks, day and night, until finally, one by one, they began to flicker out. At first, neighbors assumed that the List family was away on vacation. John List, the father, had told his children's school that they'd be taking a trip to visit their grandmother in North Carolina. He'd stopped the mail, milk and newspaper deliveries. The only thing he'd forgotten to do, it seemed, was turn out the lights. But something still didn't feel right. In early December, when darkness had finally fallen inside the List house, somebody contacted the police. As Officer George Selesnik walked up the driveway, he heard the faint sound of organ music emanating from inside the supposedly empty house. Unease coiled in his stomach. George entered the home through an open side window, then turned on his torch and began to look around. Picking up the eerie strains of the organ music, tiptoeing quietly through the house, he followed it to its source in the living room. It was coming from an automatic record player that had been left on, playing the same solemn dirge on an endless loop through loudspeakers. As he moved from the living room into a vast ballroom, the bright beam of light from George's torch illuminated a grisly scene. Four bodies, one woman, one teenage girl, and two teenage boys, placed carefully on top of sleeping bags, were lined up beside the wall. They were later identified as 45-year-old Helen List, 16-year-old Patricia List, 15-year-old John List Jr., and 13-year-old Frederick List. Later in the search, George and his fellow officers discovered a fifth victim, 84-year-old Alma List, mother of John, whose body had been left in a third-floor attic. All five had been shot dead. John List, the father, was the only family member whose fate was unclear, but not for long. On the desk in List's study, the police found a five-page letter addressed to his longtime pastor. It was a detailed and chillingly calm confession in which List described how he'd planned out the slaughter of his entire family. He wrote about his financial woes and justified the murders by claiming that he'd been trying to save his family's souls. "It may seem cowardly to have shot them from behind," he wrote, "but I didn't want any of them to know, even at the last second, that I had to do this to them." He ended the letter with an unrepentant sign-off. "P.S. Mother is in the hallway in the attic, third floor. She was too heavy to move." There was no sign of List himself anywhere, and detectives soon realized with horror that he had almost a full month's head start. By now, he could be anywhere. It was on November 9th, 1971, after months of meticulous planning, John List walked into the kitchen of his New Jersey mansion and fatally shot his wife in the back of the head. He then went up to the converted attic where his mother lived and shot her in the face, just above the left eye. Then he waited for two of his children to return home from school and shot them each in turn, before lining up their bodies in the ballroom next to their mother. Incredibly, John List then made himself some lunch, then travelled to watch John Jr. play a game of soccer, before taking him back home and shooting him too. It was 2 weeks after the List murders, on the other side of the country, that a desperate man calling himself Dan Cooper hijacked a plane for ransom money before disappearing into the night. Once the horrific details of the List family murders came out, it didn't take long for the FBI's DB Cooper task force to identify a possible link. List had been in deep financial difficulty. He'd long had trouble holding down a job and was struggling to pay the mortgage on the family's sprawling mansion. In his confession letter, he claimed he was close to bankruptcy and, crippled by shame, had killed his family to supposedly save them from having to live in ruin. The FBI didn't know much about Cooper, but they did think he was motivated by money and evidently seemed hell-bent on disappearing. Unlike Richard McCoy, List was a close match to the physical description and police sketch of Cooper. He'd gone missing 2 weeks before the hijacking, meaning he had no alibi. And after what he'd done to his family, he also fit the bill in terms of having nothing to lose. But despite a nationwide manhunt, during which his face was plastered all over front pages and television news coverage, List was nowhere to be found. As the years passed, his trail went cold, along with that of D.B. Cooper. In the spring of 1989, almost 20 years later, the story of the List family murders was broadcast on the TV show America's Most Wanted. The episode included an age-progressed approximation of what List would probably look like in the present day. A woman in Richmond, Virginia, called in with a tip. The suspect bore a striking resemblance to her neighbour, who went by the name Robert Clark. The authorities soon confirmed that it was indeed John List. He'd been living as Robert Clark in Virginia for close to 2 decades, enjoying a quiet suburban existence with a new wife who knew nothing about his past. He was promptly arrested, extradited back to New Jersey, and charged with the murders of his wife, mother, and 3 children. Although he clung to his charade for a while, List eventually admitted his true identity and confessed to his crimes. But when the FBI questioned him about the D.B. Cooper hijacking, he insisted that it wasn't him. List was found guilty on all 5 counts of murder and sentenced to 5 consecutive life sentences. He died behind bars in 2008 at the age of 82. The speculation that List was Cooper has never entirely faded, but no clear evidence ever turned up to implicate him in the hijacking, and the FBI no longer considers him a suspect. Richard McCoy and John List are just 2 of the hundreds of suspects who've been investigated in relation to the D.B. Cooper mystery over the years. But despite all of the resources and manpower that went into the search, no truly compelling lead suspect ever emerged, and no arrest was ever made. Whoever Cooper was, he changed the face of air travel forever. His high-profile hijacking, along with the spate of copycat crimes it inspired, forced the airline industry to overhaul its security protocols. The idea of screening passengers for weapons had been floated in Congress a few years earlier, but was shot down for fear that such measures would scare people away from flying. But as hijackings became more and more common, opinion started to shift. The so-called Cooper was the final straw. Beginning in January 1973, metal detectors and X-ray machines became standard at all US airports, and although ID checks for domestic flights wouldn't be introduced for another couple of decades, new security protocols were introduced for passengers who paid cash for their flight ticket on the day of departure, just as the apparent Cooper did. Airlines also began fitting their planes with a new device which prevented the stairs from being deployed during flight in order to deter copycat hijackers. In a sign of just what an indelible mark Cooper had left on the industry, this device was known as the Cooper Vane. These measures had the desired effect, and the so-called golden age of hijacking ground to a halt immediately. And so too did the hunt for Cooper himself. For close to a decade, the FBI investigated one dead-end lead after another, making no real progress. But then, in 1980, there was a break in the case. In the summer of that year, 8-year-old Brian Ingram was exploring the shores of Oregon's Columbia River during a family holiday, looking for a good spot to build a campfire. As he ran his hand along the ground, he felt something solid, partially buried in the sand. Looking closer, he spotted some kind of package, rotten and fraying, and inside it were 3 large bundles of $20 bills. Brian and his father handed the money to the authorities. They quickly confirmed the serial numbers on the banknotes to be a match for those given to D.B. Cooper. It was a brief moment of hope in a case that most had given up as a lost cause. Sadly, however, the package contained only a small portion of the ransom money, a little under $6,000. Despite an extensive search of the area, nothing else was found. There was still no sign of the mythical Cooper himself, and the presence of the money offered no further clues about where he ended up. D.B. Cooper remains a compelling enigma. His real name, his history, his motivations, and his fate are all complete unknowns. And yet, over the years, he became an unlikely folk hero in the US, inspiring movies, books, and even songs. He somehow represented both an everyman and a larger-than-life outlaw, and people found the combination irresistible. They rooted for Cooper, hoping out loud that he'd get away with every nickel. One person who was not rooting for Cooper, however, was Tina Mucklow, the flight attendant who'd been at his side throughout most of the hijacking. She, more than anybody else, had a front row seat to the kind of man that he was, and in her view, he was a lowlife. Tina was just 22 at the time, and she was determined not to let her experience on board that flight define her. After taking a few weeks off to spend time with her family, she returned to work as a flight attendant, a job she continued until she was 30. She then entered a monastery, spending several years as a nun, before going on to work in social services. For years, she avoided the spotlight, dodging endless phone calls from reporters and amateur sleuths trying to solve the Cooper case. She wanted no part of it. But in 2022, she finally relented and agreed to feature in a documentary about the hijacking, titled Nod If You Understand. Speaking with the UK's Independent newspaper, she reflected on her experience. "It has been a sad journey," she said, "to think that somebody who was a criminal and put the lives of the crew and the passengers at risk, plus any number of people on the ground, would be looked at as a hero." In 2016, the FBI officially announced that it had closed its investigation into the crime. The so-called D.B. Cooper remains the only unidentified perpetrator of a commercial airline hijacking in US history. This episode was written by Emma Dibden and produced by Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained is an AV Club Productions podcast created by Richard McLean Smith. All other elements of the podcast, including the music, were also produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, with stories never before featured on the show, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, and other bookstores. Please subscribe to and rate the show wherever you get your podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can find out more at unexplainedpodcast.com and reach us online through Twitter at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.